Israel's crimes against humanity, and on Friday, a bus emblazoned with messages calling on people to join the campaign for a free Palestine. On board were representatives of the Jewish community and clergy who say Zionism has hijacked their faith.
Zionism, this racing anti-Semitism over the world. Zionism with the acts, by the killings, in the robbery of the land, in the killing of innocent women and children, this raise anti-Semitism over the world. So Zionism doesn't save Jews at all.
As a daughter of people who survived the Holocaust, it's very important that every nation should have learned by that and learned about freedom. And how dare Jews who suffered, how dare they do the same to the Palestinians as what happened to their parents? I think it's absolutely beyond disgusting.
Carol, a Jew in the eighth decade of her life, says she is confident she will see Palestine free in her lifetime.
And this is a sentiment shared here in London and around the world, that the last apartheid on earth is about to end and justice is just around the corner for the Palestinians.
Also passionate about the Palestinian plight are Black Lives Matter activists, who say their cause has historic links to the anti-occupation movement in the occupied Palestinian territories.
I think that one day Palestine will be free, and I think it's important for us to keep up that fight. You know, I remember, and I can only equate it to South Africa. They said it could never happen. They said black people could never be free. Nelson Mandela, the idea of him being a prime minister or president was impossible. And that's what they've said about Palestine, but we are still here. And the thing is, we're not going to stop fighting and campaigning and marching and protesting until they are free.
The annual Quds Day march comes in the wake of repeated attacks on Masjid al-Aqsa and Gaza throughout the holy month of Ramadan. Young and old were being targeted, hundreds were arrested, at least 150 Palestinians were injured and 19 killed. Calls are growing louder every year for the international community to force an end to the occupation, which is not a matter of if, but when. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Islamic Republic of Iran hosted an event devoted to commemorating Quds Day as part of Moscow's Ramadan Tent, an annual charitable event organized by the Russian Council of Muftis and the Iranian Embassy in Moscow. The International Quds Day, a day of solidarity with the Palestinian people, created by Ayatollah Khamenei, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
It was a wise decision by Imam Khomeini to designate Quds Day. Using the example of the Palestinians, everyone should think about their own people and the equality of their rights. For me, Al-Quds is a symbol of a struggle for justice. That struggle is led by Iranians who have greatly contributed to the triumph of justice across the world.
I have learned from Palestinians that the struggle for justice is of greater value than religious and political doctrines. Quds Day, designated by Imam Khomeini as a day of solidarity with the Palestinians, teaches us the same thing. Palestine shows the power of faith in justice to resist powerful empires that are armed with modern weapons. Palestinian youths are only armed with stones, and all these people are armed with their faith in God.
The guests of the event told Press TV that Christians are not indifferent to the Judaization of Al-Quds. The Zionist leadership of Israel today determines what Muslims and Christians can and cannot do there, where they are allowed or not allowed, as well as the expulsion of Palestinians from their land causes rage and dissent.
Pro-Palestinian activists say making the International Quds Day is even more important today than when it was first declared in 1979, as the Israeli regime has grown more reckless and violent to the people of Palestine.
Iranian ambassador reminded that the issue of Al-Quds is not a private or personal, but international, as thousands of Palestinians were murdered and hundreds of thousands of refugees were forced to flee their homes since the beginning of the formation of Israel.
After the Camp David Treaty, the Zionist regime meant that the Islamic State would no longer resist and the Zionists would continue to expand their occupation. They suddenly ran into the approach of Imam Khomeini. He announced the Day of Al-Quds, mobilized all freedom-loving people who resist oppression against Israel. Muslims and non-Muslims rose up in support of the people of Palestine.
Марина Картунова, Москва.
Thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a to mark the International Quds Day and to voice their support for Palestinians. Senior officials and Palestinian activists were among the protesters.
We went out today to emphasize the centrality of the Palestinian cause and that Quds is the primary cause of Arabs and Muslims, and that the demise of Israel, which constitutes a cancerous gland in the region, is the basis for ending wars and conflicts in the region. The Zionist entity is behind the fragmentation in our region and is also behind the war and siege we're experiencing today against our country. The millions who went out today around the world will be the army that will liberate Palestine, God willing.
Protesters chanted slogans vowing to regain all the occupied lands all over the Arab world, especially Palestinian territories. They said the Israeli entity is only temporary and will end sooner or later.
Quds is a central and fundamental issue in our reality, our culture, and our nation, despite the failure of the Arabs in the past periods. Today, there is a direct and promising trend, and generations have changed from the past. The axis of resistance has become more cohesive, and there is a wide coordination between the axis forces and the Zionist enemy, aware of the danger of these changes.
Every year, Yemenis mark the International Quds Day as they believe that it is one way of expressing their solidarity with their Palestinian brothers. Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in Yemen, people here say it is the responsibility of all Muslims across the world to stand by the Palestinian people in the face of the Israeli aggression until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
In the limelight.
Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William I. Robinson, author. This article is published under the heading, Global Capitalism Has Become Dependent on War-Making to Sustain Itself. This is the second part of the article. By 2018, private for-profit military companies employed some 15 million people around the world, while another 20 million people worked in private security worldwide. The private security policing business is one of the fastest-growing economic sectors in many countries and has come to dwarf public security around the world. The amount spent on private security in 2003, the year of the invasion of Iraq, was 73% higher than that spent in the public sphere. And three times as many persons were employed in private forces as in official law enforcement agencies. In half of the world's countries, private security agents outnumber police officers. These corporate soldiers and police were deployed to guard corporate property, provide personal security for executives and their families, collect data, conduct police, paramilitary, counterinsurgency, and surveillance operations, carry out mass crowd control and repression of protesters, run private detention and interrogation facilities, manage prisons, and participate in outright warfare. Now, these same private military and security firms are pouring into Ukraine, with some mercenary companies offering between $1,000 and $2,000 a day for those with combat experience. The fact that this explosion in spending coincides perfectly with continued worldwide stagnation following the Great Recession suggests that the heightened militarization of the global economy is as much or more a response to this chronic stagnation than to perceived security threats. If bursts of militarized accumulation, such as that unleashed by 9/11, then by the 2008 financial collapse, and now, by the crisis in Eastern Europe, help offset the over-accumulation crisis further into the future, they are also high-risk bets that heighten worldwide tensions and push the world dangerously towards all-out international conflagration. This crisis of global capitalism is economic or structural, one of the chronic stagnation in the global economy, but it is also political, a crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. The system is moving towards a general crisis of capitalist rule as billions of people around the world face uncertain struggles for survival and question a system they no longer see as legitimate. Historically, wars have pulled the capitalist system out of crisis while they serve to deflect attention from political tensions and problems of legitimacy. Economically, global capitalism faces what is known in technical language as over-accumulation, a situation in which the economy has produced or has the capacity to produce great quantities of wealth, but the market cannot absorb this wealth because of escalating inequality. Capitalism, by its very nature, will produce abundant wealth, yet polarize that wealth and generate ever greater levels of social inequality unless offset by redistributive policies. The level of global social polarization and inequality now experienced is without precedent. In 2018, the richest 1% of humanity controlled more than half of the world's wealth, while the bottom 80% had to make do with just 5%. The International Development Agency Oxfam reported in January that during the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic, the 10 richest men in the world more than doubled their fortunes from $700 billion to $1.5 trillion, while 99% of humanity saw a fall in their income and 160 million more people fell into poverty. Such inequalities end up undermining the stability of the system as the gap grows between what is or could be produced and what the market can absorb. The extreme concentration of the planet's wealth in the hands of the few and the accelerated impoverishment and dispossession of the majority means that the transnational capitalist class, or TCC, has increasing difficulty in finding productive outlets to upload enormous amounts of surplus it accumulated. In the years leading up to the pandemic, there was a steady rise in the underutilized capacity and slowdown in industrial production around the world. The surplus of accumulated capital with nowhere to go expanded rapidly. Transnational corporations recorded record profits during the 2010s at the same time that corporate investment declined. Along with militarized accumulation, the TCC has turned to unprecedented levels of financial speculation and to debt-driven growth to sustain profit-making in the face of the crisis. If left unchecked, over-accumulation results in crisis, in a stagnation, recessions, depression, social upheavals,
and war, just what people are experiencing right now. But there is a related dynamic at work in the global war economy. The need for dominant groups to suppress mass discontent and deflect the crisis of state legitimacy. International frictions escalate as states, in their effort to retain legitimacy, seek to sublimate social and political tensions and to keep the social order from fracturing. All around the world, a people's spring has taken off. From Chile to India, France to US, Haiti to Nigeria, South Africa to Colombia, Jordan to Sri Lanka, waves of strikes and mass protests have proliferated and in some instances appear to be acquiring an anti-capitalist character. Wars and external enemies allow the ruling groups to deflect attention away from domestic melee in their effort to maintain a grip on power as the crisis deepens. In the U.S., this sublimation has involved efforts to channel social unrest towards scapegoated communities such as immigrants or other marginalized groups. This is one key function of racism and was a core component of the Trump administration's political strategy, or towards an external enemy, which had clearly become a cornerstone of the Biden government's strategy well before the crisis in Eastern Europe. U.S. presidents historically reach their highest approval ratings when they launch wars. George W. Bush reached an all-time high of 90% in 2001 as his administration geared up to invade Afghanistan, and his father, George H. W. Bush, achieved an 89% approval rating in 1991. Right as the U.S. declared the end of its first invasion of Iraq and the liberation of Kuwait. It is unlikely that an increasing militarization of the world economy can, in the long run, offset either the economic or the political dimensions of the crisis of global capitalism. Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. In the U.S., the class struggle is heating up with a wave of strikes and of unionization drives in Amazon, Starbucks, and elsewhere in the gig economy. The current inflationary spiral and the escalation of the class struggle in the United States and around the world point to the inability of the ruling groups to contain the expanding crisis. The drive by the capitalist state to externalize the political fallout of the crisis increases the danger that international tensions and localized conflicts will snowball into broader international conflagrations of unforeseen consequences.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Ukrainian conflict, it has not subsided in any shape or form. The situation is becoming more dire and dangerous. More dangerous since the way Russia sees it, the West's excessive push to arm Ukraine is fueling the conflict, possibly edging closer to a World War III scenario. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is so keen to focus only on arming Ukraine and defeating Russia, but not on ending the war and saving lives.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the U.S. and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the U.S. and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the U.S. and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the U.S. and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the U.S. on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association of the U.S., joins us from New York. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, and political analyst, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Marcus Papadopoulos, I'll start with you. Looking at the most recent development that is of significance is what happened on the ground with the Russian strikes that hit a U.S. weapons, I guess, depot at an airfield near Odessa. The Russian Defense Ministry said that this was a military airfield, and it destroyed a runway and a hangar containing the Western-supplied weapons and ammunition. To me, that sounds like progress on the Russian side.
Well, the response of the West to the Russian military campaign in Ukraine is not only about trying to deprive Russia of Ukraine, but it is also centered on the Western ruling elites attempting to preserve the global order which they established some 30 years ago following the demise of Soviet communism and the dissolution of the USSR. So on the one hand, by the West flooding Ukraine with all sorts of weaponry, the Western ruling elites are hoping to inflict a military defeat on the Russian army, which I should say is both fanciful and also exceedingly dangerous for global peace and global stability. And on the other hand, the Western ruling elites are trying now to preserve the global order, which has been in existence for three decades now, because the Western ruling elites, specifically Washington and London, are acutely aware that because of their stance on Russia, because of the sanctions they have imposed on Russia, Beijing and Moscow have become even closer. Uh-huh. And it is abundantly clear that Russia and China are now intent on dismantling the global order which the West created 30 years ago. And as regards the military situation in Ukraine, well, the Ukrainian armed forces are virtually paralyzed as a result of potent Russian military strikes on them. Furthermore, the Russians are now systematically destroying the logistics chain of the Ukrainian armed forces, which means the Ukrainian armed forces in eastern Ukraine and in southern Ukraine will not be able to be replenished with soldiers and weaponry.
Okay. Ian Williams, it doesn't sound like you agreed with anything our guests there said from London.
It's like Alice in Wonderland, everything through a looking glass. First of all, may I wish you a happy May Day, comrades all over the world. And just to get over the binary politics, I should remind you that May Day started in Chicago. It was an American holiday. It's celebrated all the world over, usually by workers parading, not by military oligarchs and dictators parading their troops in the Kremlin or Red Square or anywhere else. So having got that ritual greeting out of the way, I'd point out, who are the biggest importers of weapons into Ukraine? The Russian army brought billions of dollars worth of high technology weapons into Ukraine. No one asked them to. They brought them for free. They've been told to take them out. Oh, they want negotiations. Anytime they want peace, all they have to do is to obey international law, obey the strictures of the International Court of Justice, listen to what the rest of the world is saying, and get their troops out of there. That's all they need for peace. That's all you need. So when a bully punches someone in the face and friends come and aid the victim, oh, this is aggression. This is aggression. Let's get the perspective. It is Russian weapons, which the Ukrainians are using mostly, by the way. Most of the Ukrainian weapons supply is ex-Soviet or Russian that they bought recently from Russia. The Russian weapons is drying up. The rosy military situation that Comrade Papadopoulos talked about is not nearly as rosy. They stopped making the weapons because they relied on imported Western components, because Putin had concentrated so much on military hardware and turning the place into a failed third world petrostate, he neglected the industry. Now, he was aided in this with Western neoliberal economists who really trashed his economy for it. But he and his oligarchs were willing accomplices on this, as long as they got the money and took enough for the army. So, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around here. But the essence of it is international law, as Guterres said, the Guterres who went on a peacemaking mission, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and the Russians shelled and bombed the city that he was visiting. How is that for a gesture of peace? How is that for a gesture of good intentions? These are not equivalents. We have a brutal, rapacious dictator who has invaded another country.
Sure, let's get back
to another country with loads of weapons and is not destroying logistics. He's destroying cities. He's destroying apartment blocks.
Marcus,
he's blowing up hospitals.
Let's get Marcus's response
here.
This
is not countenanceable by any civilized measure.
The diverging views, Marcus Papadopoulos, is very evident, because I think the U.S. is calling it diabolical when they describe Putin in some sense. And I use that because Nancy Pelosi, the U.S. House Speaker, visited Ukraine very recently. I mean, first of all, why would she visit Ukraine? I mean, I think she could have done a Skype with Zelensky to show her support, but she had to somehow make sure that she was present there. Why do you think that was? The only reason I could think of here is that she wanted to make sure that, aside from, sympathize with him and show solidarity, to make sure that Zelensky actually is continuing the war. I mean, what other reasons would she have?
Well, I think there are a number of factors, one of them being that politicians in, for example, America sense an opportunity to make a name for themselves. We have to remember that the caliber of politicians in the United States is atrociously low. So people such as Pelosi are hoping to enter the textbooks of history as being the ones who played a vital role in the defeat of the Russian army and in the subsequent downfall of Vladimir Putin. But at the same time, the Americans understand in private that the Russians are winning the war in Ukraine. They understand that the Ukraine which existed prior to the 24th of February 2022 will never ever return. They understand that a new and enlarged Russian state is in the making. So by visiting Kyiv, Pelosi and other American politicians are attempting to bolster the morale of the Ukrainian ruling elite and of the Ukrainian armed forces, together with the morale of Ukrainian paramilitaries, at what is a perilous time for them. And as regards to the origins of the Russian military campaign in Ukraine, we have to be mindful that for 30 years, beginning in 1992, following the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Moscow asked, told, warned America not to extend its tentacles to Ukraine, because Ukraine is of vital importance to Russian national security and is absolutely imperative to the Russian national identity. If Russia was to extend its tentacles to Canada and Mexico, I would thoroughly condemn that. Why? Because it would be dangerous for global peace and global security.
Sure. Ian Williams, would you like to respond?
This concept has been used by other people. The last person to use it called it Lebensraum. He said the Germans had a destiny to take over their neighbours. This is what we have here. We have Russisch Lebensraum. We have the Russians saying that they have a manifest destiny. This is a bit like Britain saying, we owned Ireland for 800 years. It's ours, really. We go back in and get it any time. This type of atavistic empire building from the Slavic swamps. Remember, the Russian state was actually born in Ukraine. If anything, the Ukrainians should be taking over Moscow, which was a Mongol-ruled swamp when Russia, when the Rus was a pinnacle of civilization on the steppes there. This is atavistic, proves nothing at all. This is an evocation of history to promote Lebensraum. It's a bit like the Zionist claim to Israel. Our ancestors may have been there 3,000 years ago, so we can go and take it now and heaven help the people who are in it. It's got no relation. Now, on the case of Pelosi, I haven't got much time for Pelosi or American politicians, but I will say Pelosi and Biden and Angelina Jolie have actually gone into war zones to show their support. Vladimir Putin would only meet the Secretary General of the United Nations across a table the length of a football pitch because he's so scared that someone is going to poison him. And why is he so scared they're going to poison him? Because his laboratories, his FSB and his people are providing the wherewithal to do so and have done so to the opposition at home and abroad. This is, you know, we're in, an Alice in Wonderland world.
All right.
No time for Pelosi and the general principles, but I admire it.
Before you jump in, Marcus Papadopoulos and Ian Williams, both of you, I'd like to first thank for not interrupting each other while you were speaking, though you both disagree. But I'd like to ask both, if you'd like, you can jump in so we can make this more lively. And I say that because, in essence, we're running out of time. So, Marcus Papadopoulos, go ahead. But, of course, let's try to do it so that we can understand what each other is saying. Go ahead, Marcus.
Indeed. I abhor all forms of racism. And what I heard just now from the guest in New York was racism towards Russians. Referring to Russia as a swamp is absolutely disgusting. I would also like to say this. I would also like to say that I would also like to say I would also like to say this as well. Would you not interrupt me? Democracy is partly about respecting other people's opinions and allowing other people to speak. Now, in regard to the significance of Ukraine to Russia, if the gentleman in New York is so very au fait with the history of both Russia and Ukraine, then perhaps he can explain to me and to our audience the significance of 1654, the Treaty of Pereyaslav, and Bogdan Khmelnytsky. I suspect he will have great difficulties in being able to do that. The truth of the matter is that with the exception of the westernmost parts of Ukraine, namely Ternopil, Lviv, Ivano-Frankivsk, Rivne, and Volyn, the rest of Ukraine is directly linked to Russia and the Russian people. They are the same people. Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians are East Slavs. Much of the Ukrainian population are members of the Moscow Patriarchate. Again, you are interrupting me. You are not being respectful. I have responded to what you said, and now I will give way to you. That is partly what democracy is about.
Ian Williams, go ahead.
Excuse me, I've got... The moderator said we should cut in with each other. I am very sorry, Marco, on this, but I kept my quiet. But when you come out with absolute rubbish, I do have to contradict and get in there.
Well,
what's he done for Russia?
I got to jump in here. I'm sorry, Ian Williams. When you say that, that's kind of what Lloyd Austin said, and many are critiquing him for saying that, in a sense, because it kind of parallels what you said, in which he said the U.S. goal in this war is to weaken Russia over the long term. And some are saying that, the U.S. then lied, because that's not what it said in the beginning. In the beginning, it wanted to end what it called an insurgency that was going on. And then it went on to say there should be some peace efforts to happen. But now it has come out and said, no, our aim is to weaken Russia.
It's the U.S. that's weakened Russia. It's Putin.
Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, let me ask Marcus to jump in. Marcus Papadopoulos,
Putin managed to rip up the guarantees.
You had the U.S. Secretary of Defense, as they call it, Lloyd Austin, in that after the meeting that happened in Germany, where U.S. invited 40 countries, it said something that was very, in some ways, eye-opening, promising to move heaven and earth to ensure Ukraine's victory in the war. Now, we know that Secretary Lloyd Austin was immediately, after retiring from CENTCOM, to have joined the board of Raytheon Technologies. But aside from that...
whose shares have dropped, by the way, because they were selling to Russia, and those sales have been stopped by the sanctions.
How is that for capitalism? What does that show when you have the U.S. Secretary of, as they call it, Defense, make a statement like that, which squarely falls to a military solution, which goes hand-in-hand with the U.S. goal to weaken Russia?
And Putin isn't threatening.
That's Marcus Papadopoulos. I'm sorry, Ian Williams. Marcus Papadopoulos, go ahead.
Well, first of all, the Soviet economy, which by the time of the dissolution of the USSR was the second largest in the world, was actually destroyed by the pro-Western agenda of Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin. It had nothing to do with Vladimir Putin. I would also add that the gentleman in New York's knowledge of Soviet history and Russian history is not just lamentable, but it is also laughable. Now, turning to the American Defense Secretary's remarks, the Americans are attempting to inflict a military defeat on the Russian army with the knowledge that if Russia was to lose in Ukraine, and if Ukraine was to remain in the West's sphere of influence and one day join NATO, then Russia could never hope to be the superpower that it was in Soviet times. Ukraine is absolutely imperative to Russia, not just in terms of Russian national security, but also in terms of Russian global power as a whole. So the Americans
want the jewel and the crown of the British Ukrainian armed forces
to try and defeat the Russian military.
So now I got to jump in now and give because we're almost out of time. Ian Williams, 30 seconds to you. I'm sorry, Marcus. Ian Williams, 30 seconds. Are we looking at this conflict to have gone global? Marcus, go ahead.
Let me say, the Americans are also making a racket by supplying the Saudi Arabian military with so much weaponry that the Saudis have killed some 200,000 Yemeni men, women, and children. The Americans do not care. About humanity.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. We are out of time. I'm sorry about that. We're fresh out of time. Thank you. Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association of the U.S. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you. Author, historian, political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavli, it's goodbye.
In the limelight. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland. The piece is titled, Jacob Rees-Mogg Has Given the Game Away. Even this government knows Brexit is a disaster. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. On a visit to the Eurotunnel terminal at Folkestone, high-visibility gilet over his double-breasted suit, Jacob Rees-Mogg announced that the government was delaying yet again the imposition of post-Brexit border checks on imports from the European Union. He asked the public to celebrate this decision on the grounds that it would save £1 billion a year and help hard-pressed consumers by avoiding an increase in the cost of imported food. Enforcing post-Brexit checks, said the minister, would have been an act of self-harm. You read that right. Jacob Rees-Mogg, the arch-leaver and long-time loather of the European Union, is now parroting lines from the Remain campaign. He's admitting that implementing Brexit in full, honouring the 2016 promise to take back control of Britain's borders, would be an act of self-harm. There's plenty to attack here, starting with the nerve of hailing this move as saving Britain's £1 billion, when this was £1 billion that Britons would never have had to spend at all if it hadn't been for Brexit. Or you could share the outrage of British farmers, appalled that thanks to Brexit, they have been left at a serious competitive disadvantage. They now face onerous and costly checks when they ship their goods across the Channel, while French, Italian and Spanish farmers face no such hassle moving their farm produce in the other direction. Or you could worry along with the British Veterinary Association, which warns that not checking food imports leaves Britain exposed to catastrophic animal diseases, such as African swine fever, a risk that was reduced when Britain was part of the European Union's integrated and highly responsive surveillance systems. Or you could join the lament of the UK Major Ports Group, whose members have spent hundreds of millions of pounds building checking facilities, which now stand unused as bespoke white elephants. But put all of that aside for now, just for a moment, and grasp the full meaning of Jacob Rees-Mogg's admission. He and his fellow Brexiters once looked forward to these border checks, seeing them not merely as a price worth paying for leaving the European Union, but as a genuine benefit. Britain would at last be free to set its own food standards superior to the European Union's. And yet, now the minister admits that putting up barriers just makes food more expensive for British consumers and risks bankrupting British farmers. Precisely the act of self-harm that Remainers always said it would be. The irony of hearing Jacob Rees-Mogg declare that free trade is hugely advantageous to consumers after he and his comrades pulled us out of the largest, most successful free trade bloc in the world, namely the European single market, would be funny if it weren't so bitter. At a stroke, the Minister for Brexit Opportunities has implicitly admitted that there are none. Or, at the very least, any opportunities are outweighed by costs so great that they represent economic self-mutilation. In the long story of Britain's needless and pointless departure from the European Union, the Rees-Mogg admission should count as a milestone. Which is not to say the Conservatives won't keep banging the Brexit drum, hoping it will rally the electoral coalition it summoned back in 2019. But the sound, always hollow, will now be hollower still. Thanks to Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Brexiteers themselves have admitted as much. This matters not just as a twist in the Brexit saga, but for the life expectancy of this government. For Brexit was this government's founding purpose. When the best that even the loudest advocates for that project can promise is a delay in its realisation, it's clear the drive has gone. And without such a goal, a destination to aim for, governing parties drift and become vulnerable. If the two usual determinants of an incumbent administration's popularity are the economy and the personal standing of the leader, those now combine dangerously for the Conservatives. The cost of living crisis is both deep and wide, reaching into families that had previously been getting by, albeit with a struggle. It's the mother living off a tin of soup for herself so that her children can eat. It's the parent getting the kids to change into pyjamas when they get home from school to avoid wearing out their school uniforms. But this crisis runs in parallel with Partygate, each revelation of indulgence at No. 10 Downing Street affronting not only those who followed the rules and denied themselves contact with loved ones during lockdown, but all those who do not have the money to put bread on the table, let alone pay for a suitcase full of booze. This is a Marie Antoinette government pampering itself while too many of its people go hungry. The usual alibis are no longer working. The much-trumpeted vaccine rollout is increasingly offsetting the public mind both by Partygate and the handling of the first phase of the pandemic. Witness this week's High Court ruling that discharging people from hospitals into care homes was both irrational and unlawful. A new opinion poll shows a sharp decline in the number of voters ready to forgive those early decisions just because they're glad they got the jab. Nor does law and order any longer offer its traditional comfort to the Conservatives, not when new figures show overall crime has increased by 18% in the past 2 years, with the proportion of those charged down to just 5.8%. On almost every issue, from inflation to immigration, from tax to housing, and the National Health Service, big majorities think the government is handling things badly. Only on defence and terrorism do the Tories get positive marks. No wonder they like to hail Boris Johnson as a leader on Ukraine, though that is of limited political value. Most voters surely sense that today's Labour Party would not be doing anything different. In normal circumstances, you would say this spells doom for Boris Johnson. He lags behind Labour and Keir Starmer on the two big ones, the economy and the leadership. People are far worse off than they were, and they have lost all trust in Boris Johnson. His government is stripped of its defining purpose, leaving it exposed to daily squalls and scandal. And yet, while the evidence is strong that voters are making the break from this government, they're not yet fully sold on the alternative. The old line says it's governments that lose elections rather than oppositions that win them. But changing governments is a two-stage process. First, the electorate moves away from the incumbent party, then it moves towards the challenger. Labour and Keir Starmer have work to do on that second stage. But the first phase is well underway, and Jacob Rees-Mogg's accidental truth revealed one reason why.